Good morning. You're tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, the beloved Community Village, an intentional community in Denver that's home to people coming off the streets, moved to a new location in Globeville on Monday. KGNU's Ray Solomon was there and brings us a report. Then, this coming Saturday is an opportunity to celebrate World Migratory Bird Day at the St. Vrain State Park. We'll hear what birds are passing through and migrating to Colorado and what problems they're facing due to climate change, plastic pollution and habitat loss. Two regular Wednesday morning features, Chris Moore and Make Them Hear You, followed by Naturally with Brigitte Mars. Then after headlines from the BBC at the bottom of the hour, we'll have a new commentary from Jim Hightower. And then it's time to take a look back at the 2019 state legislative session. We'll be joined in studio by Steve Fenberg, who was the state Senate Majority Leader, and Speaker of the House, Casey Becker, both Democrats from Boulder. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Yesterday, the Broomfield City Council unanimously approved a six-month moratorium on oil and gas applications to allow the city time to update its ordinances. The state legislature passed a law last session that gives Broomfield and other local governments the ability to exercise more control over oil and gas operations in their jurisdictions. The governor signed the measure about a month ago. The Broomfield moratorium will last until November 14th, although some members were in favor of a longer period. The Denver Post reports that a spokesperson for the Colorado Petroleum Council said that the moratorium sends a message that the industry is not welcome. However, Councilmember Elizabeth Law Evans said that the point of the move is not to penalize the industry, but to allow the city to make good, solid decisions. The new state law allows local governments to regulate surface operations and nuisance impacts without being preempted by state law, according to a city memo prepared for the meeting. Both Adams County and the city of Lafayette have placed similar moratoriums on oil and gas development. The Broomfield City Council will conduct a second reading of its measure on May 28th. Yesterday, the Boulder City Council voted down, for now, a proposed fee on cars and a tax on natural gas, both of which would raise funds to fight climate change. City staff had outlined the possible vehicle fee and a gas tax and wrote in a memo that the aggressive goals of Like Boulder's on climate commitment are not going far enough or fast enough. However, the Daily Camera reports that council members expressed various reservations and the whole council decided to defer action on the two proposals. Under one of them, the average fee on a vehicle registered in the city would be about $250, which staff cautioned against as it would almost triple the average fees for drivers. Councilman Aaron Brockett asked Kendra Tupper, the city's chief sustainability and resilience officer, if she thought the fee would serve as an incentive. She said it would not, and that is one of the key issues the staff identified. Another council concern was that the fee would not apply to those who drive their cars into Boulder to work. Council members expressed reservations about the proposed tax on natural gas based on its timing in light of future tax measures. The governor's office of New Mexico paid about $4,000 to transport 55 Central American asylum seekers to Denver, who arrived early Sunday morning. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's office coordinated with Annunciation House, a nonprofit organization that works with migrants on the border of El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico, to transport the immigrants because shelters there were over capacity. The Denver Post reports that it was the first time Annunciation House has sent immigrants to another state. Border Patrol agents have been releasing asylum seekers to bus stations, giving them no way to contact the sponsors who assist them in their applications. Governor Jared Polis of Colorado said that he supports providing humanitarian assistance to asylum seekers. Three Denver area churches offered up their spaces for shelter to the migrants, most of whom are from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. A former Republican state legislator has blasted his party's leadership for seeking the recall of a Democratic representative. Tom Sullivan, a Democratic representative from Aurora, is facing recall after his support for the red flag law that allows a judge to order the removal of guns from an owner if the person poses a threat to themselves or others. Sullivan defeated Cole Wist, a Republican from Centennial, in last year's election. But yesterday, Wist said in a tweet that he does not support the recall of Sullivan and said that the GOP leadership had failed to defend him when he backed an earlier version of the red flag bill. Wist also said that the gun rights organization, Rocky Mountain Gun Owners, owns the Colorado Republican Party. The Colorado Springs Gazette reports that the organization is working to recall 12 members of the legislature, including Sullivan. His son Alex was murdered in the 2012 Aurora Theater shooting that killed 12. The ACLU of Colorado has sued a state representative saying that he blocked a constituent from his Facebook page. Colorado Politics reports that the constituent regularly commented and posted on the page of State Senator Ray Scott, a Republican from Grand Junction. When the constituent wrote a comment criticizing his position on climate change, she was blocked from his Facebook page. The suit claims that the constituent's First Amendment rights have been violated by the blocking. The Democratic president of the state Senate, Leroy Garcia, recently settled a similar suit after a person was blocked on his Facebook page. At least one federal court has ruled that the public officials cannot block comments on digital platforms that are used to conduct official government business and to interact with their constituents. Colorado's health department is advising people who travel to parts of the U.S. or overseas where there are measles outbreaks to make sure they have or have had or get the vaccine against the disease. A department spokesman said in his statement that it is essential for persons who are traveling to those areas to know their vaccination or immunity status. She said that measles, which was once considered eliminated in the U.S., has made a comeback. In today's weather, it will be mostly sunny, with highs in around the mid-80s and a chance of storms in the afternoon. Tomorrow, just about the same, partly sunny with highs in the mid-80s and afternoon storms possible. Right now, it's 59. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It's just coming up on 11 minutes past 8 o'clock. Well, on Monday, a major relocation operation happened in Denver. A group of tiny homes that have housed formerly homeless people was moved to a new location in Globeville. KGNU's Ray Solomon was there and brings us this report.
Beloved Community Village is an intentional community in Denver that houses people coming off the streets. For nearly 2 years, the colony of tiny homes has been near the corner of 38th Avenue and Blake Street, just a step from the first stop out of Union Station on Denver's A-Line train. On Monday morning, that changed. A forklift and a couple flatbed trucks descended on the village to move the entire community, tiny home by tiny home, to its new site down the road in the Globeville neighborhood. The community has spent months anticipating this day. The planning has been bumpy, and it's been in the works for nearly a year. The villagers have all decamped to a hotel in northeast Denver for the duration of the move. One of them, a woman named Aurora, describes the experience.
It's more stressful than anything. We had to pack up, and pretty quickly. It's not fun. But it's something that I've come to accept. If I have to move every 6 months to keep a house, if that's the worst of my problems, then I guess I will, but it doesn't mean I have to like it.
For the village residents, these houses are a lifeline, a chance for stability and dignity in a city where the skyrocketing cost of living has made housing unaffordable for many people.
Is this the house they're taking? Probably gonna be now.
But right now, they represent a logistical problem for the movers.
Yeah, we're gonna start with these three here.
These three? All right.
The first to go happens to be house number 9. A doormat and a can of Coke sit on the front porch. Through the window, you can see a rod lined with neatly hung clothing. A worker maneuvers the forklift under the floorboards. The house, about the size of a shed, is lifted, intact, off of her foundations. Driven across the site and lowered onto a waiting flatbed truck parked in the alley.
All right, coming off the concrete now onto the trailer. We're clearing the wires now, so you can do what you want.
4 bare concrete blocks mark the corners where number 9 just stood. Soon, these two will be scooped up and secured to the flatbed. The community supporting the village hopes it will be an enduring institution, but its physical home is necessarily temporary. Zoning laws restrict the length of time a permit for the village may be granted. Also, the village doesn't own any land. The very ground beneath the tiny homes is on loan and presently slated for development. Thus, this whole relocation operation happening today. The village's new site is at the corner of 44th Avenue and Pearl Street. It's only about a half mile away, about 3.5 minutes by car, but the house's roof ridge makes for a tall load, so number 9 takes the scenic route around to avoid low clearances.
All right, I think I see the lights of the truck.
30 minutes later, we see that same roof ridge again, peeking above a fence as the truck rolls up 44th Street. The new site is covered in smooth asphalt. An active freight train line crosses the southern end of the site on top of a very narrow, very steep embankment. Across Pearl Street, to the west, the neighborhood is residential. Planters and children's toys accent a row of small houses not that much bigger than the tiny homes moving in across the street. Mounted to the front of one of those houses, a banner reads, "No Tiny Home Village in Globeville," a reminder of the controversy the beloved community village has stirred up. Many Globeville residents don't want the village of formerly homeless people in their neighborhood. One of those neighbors, a woman named Loretta, watches the activity on the other side of the fence.
Right now, is I'm at that anger stage, and it's not going away from that anger, you know, because I feel like we've just been jacked around too damn many times. It makes me want to cuss, fuss, and carry on and on and on. And they want to bring these people in there, and they haven't done a good background check on them.
When everyone is ready, the flatbed backs onto the site, and the process is reversed. The four foundation blocks are forklifted into place, one at a time. Then the forklift comes for number 9. The house wobbles in the wind as she crosses the site. With number 9 hovering inches above her foundations, a problem is discovered.
The foundation blocks are supposed to be in underneath.
The concrete blocks have been placed too far apart. So number 9 is set aside while the forklift nudges each foundation block a couple of feet inward, and the distances are confirmed. Finally, number 9 rises again and is restored solidly to her foundations. For number 9, all things told, the move has been pretty smooth. The doormat still covers her front porch, and inside, the clothes still hang straight and neat on their hangers. The coat can? Well, that seems to have gotten lost in the move, but number 9 isn't fazed. For the moment, she stands alone on the site. Over the next few hours and days, she will be joined by the remaining 11 structures that currently make up Beloved Community Village. In a few weeks, the village will be filled again with people and community. Number 9 will be filled again with life. And soon enough, someone will be back on her front porch, sipping a new refreshing drink. This is Ray Solomon for KGNU.
And you can see photos from the move of the beloved village that all happened on Monday. That's all online at news.kgnu.org. Well, this coming Saturday, May 18th, is World Migratory Bird Day. There's going to be a celebration at the St. Vrain State Park. I spoke with Susan Bonfield, who's the director of Environment Americas, which is co-presenting the event.
Well, it's very difficult to be a migratory bird. There are a lot of factors that threaten their populations or individuals as they migrate north and south and as they stop and rest and refuel. This year, we're focusing on the impacts of plastic pollution, and that, of course, has a big impact on many migratory birds, and there's a big focus on marine species right now, but it also impacts some of those species that we see inland, such as osprey. Entanglement or ingestion of plastics can kill migratory species. In addition, big buildings with glass pane windows are difficult because birds don't see pane glass, and so many are killed as they fly into windows during migration and, you know, at times when they're not migrating as well, but migration is a particularly difficult time. Cats that are allowed to roam outdoors outside of the house. Cats are one of the biggest killers of birds, including they also kill migratory birds as well as non-migratory species. So there are many factors that affect them. Loss of habitat, of course, and climate change.
Well, at this time of year, as we are celebrating World Migratory Bird Day, it's happening Saturday, May 18th, that there is an event in Longmont at the St. Vrain State Park. What birds are we seeing either migrating through Colorado this time of year or have migrated to Colorado this time of year?
Well, mostly right now we're going to see some of the species that have migrated to Colorado at this time. So, of course, you know, a lot of our warblers are already singing and starting to nest, such as yellow warblers. Osprey are back, and if they left at all. So they'll be nesting and getting ready for the breeding season as well. We have any variety of thrushes and just other species of shorebirds and waterbirds that have migrated to the state to nest and breed. So some of them will be here, you know, into August. Others will leave even earlier than that.
Are we seeing changes at all in the migration of birds due to some of the issues that you mentioned earlier, loss of habitation, plastic pollution, obviously, particularly for some of the marine birds? But in terms of the birds that are coming to and passing through Colorado, are you seeing any big changes at all?
Well, definitely changing seasons are affecting birds. For example, we have broad-tailed hummingbird, which is, of course, a very popular species in Colorado. It's our little dynamo that nests here and feeds on our nectar-producing plants. Broad-tailed hummingbirds are starting to arrive earlier in the state because of warming temperatures. And of course, some of the flowering plants that they feed on are also starting to bloom earlier. So, you know, one of our big concerns is that our birds be able to track their food source as they migrate. Hummingbirds depend on these flowering plants. So we want to make sure that when they arrive, they have the flowering plants that they need to survive and that they're going to feed on, and then they're going to have the energy to feed their young as well.
We've done a lot of coverage on the impact on pollinators, say, of increased pesticide use and also GMOs. Are we seeing that impacting the birds in any way? Because so much of those insects and then the plants as well, they're also food sources.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's very difficult to test some of these species for the impacts of pesticides and herbicides. There have been some more recent studies that have developed and the development of technologies that help us to study small birds such as hummingbirds to see if we can detect some of those chemicals on them. And indeed, we are finding that they are carrying some of those chemicals on their feathers and even ingesting them when they forage on nectar-producing plants.
Is there a piece of policy that you think could really impact what's happening with the birds right now that we could see introduced either at a state level to just deal with what's happening in Colorado or nationally or regionally, given the very nature of the migration patterns of the birds?
Well, there definitely are many policies that we could work towards to help protect migratory birds and other wildlife, as well as ourselves. We've worked on some of that. So I think that we're seeing, because of the increased awareness of the impacts of plastic pollution, we're seeing more plastic bag bans. We're seeing more say no to straws, plastic straws. We're seeing a lot of people changing their behavior so that they're using fewer plastics in their personal lives and as they shop and as they go about their daily lives. And I think those are all wonderful ways to help reduce the impacts on migratory birds and other species. Of course, you know, we would love to see a careful look at the chemicals that we use on the food that we eat. That, of course, is important to us as humans and our health as well. And then, of course, we want to look at our fossil fuel use and how we protect our planet in terms of climate change and our carbon footprint.
Obviously, folks like yourself are very invested and very engaged with what's happening with the birds. Other people, obviously, they notice birds, but they don't necessarily pay as much attention to them. But why should we be paying attention to them? I mean, there is that old saying, the canary in the coal mine.
Exactly.
Of course, a bird can be indicative of a bigger crisis. But, you know, what can we learn about what's happening to us as human species or the planet as a whole from paying attention to the birds?
Well, you just said it. We're all interconnected, and birds are the, you know, they are the indicator of the health of our environment. And that's been known for a long time. As you say, they are the canaries in the coal mine. Their populations are indicators of activities that are going on that are harmful to them as well as to us. And we see that in many ways. And so when we see loss of bird species and loss of numbers of different species of birds, then what we're seeing is those impacts that are happening in our environment, whether it be climate change or chemicals or plastic pollution.
That's Susan Bonfield, who's the director of Environment Americas. They're co-presenting an event to honour World Migratory Bird Day, and it's happening this coming Saturday, May 18th at the St. Vrain State Park. It goes from 9 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. and there'll be lots of things for all ages, all members of the family. You can learn about migratory birds. There will be scopes there so you can do some bird watching, hear about the impact of plastics on birds and a lot more. So that's this coming Saturday from 9 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. at the St. Vrain State Park. And there is a charge per car, so it's also an opportunity to lower your carbon footprint by carpooling. We'll put more information online at news.kgnu.org. It's time now for Make Them Hear You.
Make them hear you.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas of how you can have your voice heard before Congress. This week we circle back to prisoners, ex-cons, and voting rights. Depending on which state people are in, some people who have served a prison sentence are excluded from electing their own representatives. States vary in their approach to voting rights, leaving millions of Americans without the right to vote, including 13% of African-American men. Giving ex-cons the right to vote has proven to be surprisingly popular in states like Florida, and thanks to Kim Kardashian, President Trump even seems open to prison reform in general. The Democracy Restoration Act, H.R. 196, or Senate Bill 1068, would give returning citizens the right to vote in federal elections all across the country. As the ACLU points out, felony disenfranchisement laws are rooted in the Jim Crow era and were intended to bar minorities from voting. The impact of these laws continues today. The rate of African-American men who can't vote is 7 times above the national average. Latino citizens are also disproportionately disenfranchised. And these numbers have been increasing because of an incarceration boom fueled by mandatory minimum sentences and the war on drugs. In turn, this has impacted the families of those who are disenfranchised and the communities in which they reside by reducing their collective political voice. The United States is one of the few Western democratic nations that excludes such large numbers of people from the democratic process. Not only is disenfranchising millions of citizens undemocratic, but it is counterproductive to the rehabilitation and reintegration into society of those released from prison. Confusion regarding state felony disenfranchisement laws has resulted in legitimate voters, sometimes even those with no disqualifying criminal conviction, being purged from the rolls or denied the ability to register to vote or cast their ballots. States have vastly different approaches to voting with a criminal conviction. The provisions of the Democracy Restoration Act would restore voting rights in federal elections to nearly 4 million Americans who've been released from prison and are living in the community, create a uniform standard across the country in federal elections, strengthen our democracy by creating a broader and more just base of voter participation, aid law enforcement by encouraging participation in civic life, facilitate education administration by streamlining registration issues and eliminating the opportunity for erroneous purges of eligible voters, eliminate the confusion about who is eligible to vote. As the Supreme Court has said, quote, no right is more precious in a free country than that of having a voice in the election of those who make the laws. Other rights are illusory if the right to vote is undermined. If you have an opinion on the Democracy Restoration Act, H.R. 196, or Senate Bill 1068 for returning prisoners, you can contact your senators and representative. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
Time now for Naturally.
Greetings, welcome to Naturally. This is Brigitte Mars. If you suffer from allergies, what are some of the natural alternatives and things you can do? Well, I do think that during the hay fever season, you want to not overburden your immune system with using foods that create a lot of phlegm. And that often means dairy products, milk, cheese, ice cream, etc., as well as glutinous products, wheat and rye and barley. So you want to focus on being more alkaline, eating more fresh fruits and vegetables. I find that pungent herbs like garlic, onions, horseradish, cayenne are really good at helping to open the bronchioles. And of course, if you haven't heard me say it before, one meal a day, green leafy vegetables. Lots of, you know, green grassy things. But what are some of the remedies we can use for hay fever? Well, one in particular that's had a lot of study and success is stinging nettles. And there was a study done in Portland, Oregon at a naturopathic college, and they found that when people took freeze-dried nettles, it really diminished the runny nose, the itchy eyes, the swelling in the face. And so consider nettles. There's also a flavonoid called quercetin, which occurs in onions. And quercetin is also great for immunity from allergies. I want to say one more thing about nettles. It's good for people that are allergic to almost everything. I think nettles is such an amazing herb. So there's homeopathic remedies, and there's a remedy called Allergia Zone 6, which is actually designed for the pollens in this area. So if you have allergies, you may find that cleaning your air filters and air duct to be a helpful thing to do your errands early in the morning, but also look at pollen counts for the day. Some days might be better than others for going out and doing your errands. Something that people used to do and should probably still do is bathing their eyes to wash some of the pollen that's accumulated from the eyes. You might also consider, I'm not big on neti pots to use all the time, but rinsing your nasal passages when there's high pollen content can also help. And of course, you know, things that are going to create more dust, sleeping with stuffed animals or sleeping with your pets or just having a lot of dust in your environment is not such a great idea. You might need to keep your windows closed to minimize the amount of pollen that comes into the house. So vitamin C with bioflavonoids might be helpful. There's an herb called eyebright. So nature might be the reason we have allergies, but it also has the remedies. So thanks for joining me, Brigitte Mars, on Naturally.